Kathy Svitina, and this is The Efficiency Code, your guide to unlocking peak performance in finance and procurement. Listen as we decode the strategies of top industry leaders who are redefining efficiency and optimization. From spend management to lean operations, discover how to achieve more with less. Join us as we crack the code to sustainable growth. My guest today is Melissa Herrington. Melissa is an experienced finance leader with deep expertise in scaling operations, strategic growth, and financial optimization. As a Chief Financial Officer and VP of Operations at Premier Claims, Melissa has been pivotal in driving the company's rapid expansion, overseeing finance, HR, IT, and sales. She has helped scale Premier Claims from a small startup to a leading nationwide public adjusting firm, helping policyholders navigate complex insurance claims with expert support. Melissa's diverse career includes roles in public accounting, technology, nonprofit, and hospitality finance, giving her a broad perspective across industries. Her leadership is guided by her 1% better philosophy, emphasizing continuous improvement and efficiency. Melissa embodies a leadership style that combines strategic vision with practical execution. As a CFO, she champions a holistic approach to financial leadership that focuses on strategic growth and operational excellence. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here today.
I'm super excited that you're here as well. But first, let's start here. What does sustainable growth mean to you, and how have you applied it as Premier Claims CFO?
Sustainable growth, without just repeating the words back to you, is to me, it's growth that's repeatable. You can get quick wins. You can get those in business. There's those peaks and valleys. But for me, sustainable growth means just repeatable processes that will lead to growth time and time and time and time again. To me, it's almost like when you talk about it, I actually think of the opposite of like sustainable weight loss, right? You can go on a crash diet. You can make it happen. You can fit into that dress by that wedding or that event or whatever it may be, but it's not sustainable over time. And that's exactly what I think about kind of in that business sense, is you can do things that are going to shoot sales through the roof, but are those clients ever going to come back to you again and again and again? Or are you just getting that like one time quick hit? So it's that true, repeatable, foundational things that need to be put in place as a business.
That's very well said. And I always say that there's a way that you can make a P&L look so much better. You just slash all the cost. But yes, what is that going to do for you in the long run?
Yeah.
Maybe in a few months or maybe a quarter or two is going to look good. But how is that going to look a year or two from now?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how have you applied this in your current role?
Every day, truthfully, in different ways. It's typically not, especially when you talk about sustainability, it's not these like sweeping changes. It's just, it's a mindset of day in and day out of, is something we talk about a lot here, it's a little buzzwordy, but is this a Band-Aid? Is this something that's going to like bridge the gap for a little bit? Or is it something that's going to be there again into the future, right? So is this something, especially right now, I look at it a lot from the perspective of technology. Mm-hmm. There is always something sexy and new on the market. And it's easy to like just want to adopt the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. It's all very flashy. But is this the thing that we're going to implement? And can we see ourselves using it 3 years from now? If we're going to spend all the time getting the buy-in, your change management, all of that. But is this a process, a system? Is this a person that I can see being here years from now?
Yeah. And I like that you included the change management and the people in there, yeah, as well, because it's not just making an investment in a particular tool that you're using. There's also all the implementation, the change management, the people changes that come with it. Yeah. And a lot of times businesses don't take that account, and yeah, then it just skyrockets in terms of cost.
Yes.
Do you have a framework that you're using when you're trying to make those decisions? Obviously, it's not just about the cost, but it's also about other things. Like, what are you looking through when you're making those decisions?
Boy, this is going to be an honest answer and probably not the right answer, but a lot of times it's gut instinct. There's the cost. Like, you have to do the ROI, otherwise you can't consider yourself to be a CFO? That's for sure. Like, does it fit into the budget? What is the ROI of this kind of an investment? But a lot of it just comes down to gut instinct. You can always count on a CFO to slow things down, to dig our heels in and be like, whoa, hold on. Let's give this another thought. Let's think a little bit longer about it. And I fit check mark next to that on that stereotype for sure. But a lot of it is instinct, supported by research, doing the analysis, doing the research of something that maybe I'm not familiar with. But I got to be honest, I don't necessarily have a huge framework. It's taking the time to pause and actually ask the question, can you see us using this tool in 2027? Mm-hmm. That sounds light years away. Like AI robots are here. So who knows what 2027 is going to be. So when you say that number, it sounds so futuristic, right? But just to take those, sometimes it's just 5 minutes of stop. Is this, I like to challenge people and say, is this the best use of X amount of dollars? Are we making a $10,000 decision? Are we making a six-figure decision? Is this the best way to spend $10,000? Can you see yourself spending that money on this service, whatever it may be, for 3 years? Can you envision using this in 2027? That it's typically enough to make people pause and say like, oh, yeah, yes, I hope this is something that we use until the next thing comes along that replaces it and makes it ancient, or go, wow, no, I can't. Well, then this isn't the one, because there's so many indirect costs, kind of like you said, of anytime you're implementing a change in any capacity, and it's all change. Business right now is just change. Because technology is advancing so quickly, but there is so much indirect cost tied to just this like repeated change that is healthy, that your business needs to go through. You can't stay stagnant, that's for sure. But to not, I never want to downplay it, that cost might not stick out on a P&L, but it is certainly there, and it's a lot, probably very underestimated by most people.
Yeah. And as you said, I mean, the Band-Aid analogy is really appropriate here, because you're looking at it in the long term. You're not just slapping in. It's like, oh, we need help with this particular issue right now, but it might just be right now in the next 6 months. You know, let's see how this works later on. So, you know, as you were talking about, technology is such a huge cost for businesses these days.
Yeah.
And especially usage-based cost also. Are there any particular ways that you have found that it's helpful to rein that in a little bit?
Everything I just said, for sure. All of that, so I won't repeat it. But the thing that I have found to be most powerful is to, before implementing something, there's so much out there. Stop and ask, like, do I even have this problem that this technology is solving? Because sometimes like the solution is so powerful and it looks so good and their marketing team is crushing it, that you like are like, oh, I think we have that problem. I think we have that problem, and look at, it's going to solve all the things. So keeping your priorities straight, you have to be really clear of it. It's that saying, like, you can't boil the whole ocean, right? So like, what are our problems? What are our priorities that we are trying to solve? And then find the right solution for it. So A, you have to start there. Then I say there's so much technology out there right now that if they say it is so fantastic, you're never going to be able to live without it, great. We negotiate for a living, so some of this stuff might be a little crazy for someone else to think about, but anytime I'm implementing a new technology of any kind, I negotiate into it a trial period. Now, I'm not talking 3 or 4 days. If your technology is everything that you are claiming it's going to be, and I am never going to be able to live without it again, then give me an opt-out in 3 months. And in 3 months, there's no way I'm going to opt out of it, because you changed my life. right? We cannot live without it. So I'll sign your 2-year contract, your 3-year commitment, whatever it may be, but I negotiate in a long-term opt-out. And when people, implementation never goes according to plan. And if anyone deals with SaaS salespeople, I think they're the best in the business. So you promise a 45-day implementation and it's happened repeatedly and everyone's satisfied with it, then also give me the opt-out if implementation takes longer than 45 days. So that's the point I ask for. I'll sign your contract today, but I want an opt-out if implementation is not met on the agreed upon timeframe. And then once fully implemented, I like to ask for 3 months. So not like a trial necessarily, like full blown. We are in, it is implemented into my CRM. It's integrated. We've done training. We are using it.
Yep.
And if I can't live without it, then I'll skip over the opt out. So those are the things that I have found have really kept things in line for us to not get distracted, because it all sounds so exciting, and it is exciting, and it's
the next shiny object out there. Yeah.
Yeah. My mind is blown by the capabilities of things that are out there and people that are being so innovative with it. But yes, you can find a whole bookshelf, I suppose, with all the shiny objects on it that cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars and 3-year commitments, and you're all in on it. And it is so much harder in a 3-year contract at year one to try to negotiate in some capacity to get out early, like good luck, Chuck. But to just say that, let me try this on for size. And when it's love, it's love. And most of the time it is, right? But to give yourself that option.
So would you think that because you're doing this trial period, you are more open to just pulling the plug and just saying, okay, we're going to try this out, see what happens, even though it took us time and effort to implement this, versus being more cautious and then extending that period of decision making even more? So it almost seems like you're more nimble in that terms versus some companies out there that are taking a year to actually even figure out, do we want to implement this? Do we not want to implement it? What do we want to do?
Yeah, we move fast and furious. It is a blessing and a curse. It's our biggest strength and our biggest weakness. Like, make no mistake. We make decisions fast and jump straight into the deep end. That tends to be, as a company, what we like to do. So if something's out there, I want it, and I want it by Friday, and let's get things going, and when can implementation happen? But again, not downplaying the sunk costs and the heavy costs of implementation. So we aren't out here just being like, yeah, sure, just we'll try this on and try this on and try this on, because that change fatigue is real.
Yep.
So I'm not implementing anything that I don't wholeheartedly believe is the solution, and that I do want to use long term. But everybody's done it, right? I mean, it's online shopping. It comes and you're in the mail. When it comes to you in the mail and you're committed and you try it on, it's like, it's not love for me, but do I hate it enough to return it? Is totally different than when you go to the store and you go in the dressing room and you actually try it on. Do I love it enough to buy it? It's just, it's two different mindsets. And I'm not sure if that analogy necessarily knocked it out of the park, but right, it's just like, it's two different mindsets of that. Like, it just comes and we're committed and you kind of deal with it. You find reasons that it's doing what it has to do, versus I'm still committed. I'm still here. I still want the right solution, but I'm not going to walk out of the store unless I'm confident that it's the one.
Yep. And how do you deal with change management internally? Obviously, you have people that are implementing that from a vendor side, but how do you guys deal with that internally?
I am very transparent with my team as a whole that change is the only constant. It is happening faster than ever in business. So you have to embrace it. Again, technology driven. Technology is changing faster than any of us can comprehend. So what you were doing 2 years ago at this point is ancient, like archaic. And that's wild. Absolutely wild. It used to be, I feel like, that you would promote and promote and promote and promote and promote and then look back and be like, wow, back when I was a staff accountant, we had the green general ledgers and used pencils.
I remember those.
Right? Like, but you were here instead, like when you start a job and a year and a half, 2 years later, you're still in that same role, which is not a crazy amount of time. Like what you were doing when you started is totally different than what you're doing now because that technology is moving so fast. So you got to embrace it. So we talk consistently about it, and it's just using that language, like change is the only constant. I will say we specifically hire for it. I'm not going to say we crush it, but it's something I discuss a lot in an interview to be perfectly clear that people coming in are excited by that because there's two camps, right? Like there's two camps of people that just like, I want to be left alone. Show me how to do my job. I'm going to meet your expectations every single time. My work is going to be fantastic and you're never going to have to worry about me. And then people that are like, I want something new by Tuesday. And then what about next Thursday? Let's keep it fresh, keep it going. And it's just two different personality types. And so being very clear that here, that the change is going to be constant. And that's what I'm looking for. That's a dream role for a lot of people, not for everyone. And so I think being clear of that is kind. And then just making sure that you are giving some level of empathy to the employee experience. It can be exhausting for even the people that are most excited by something fresh and new all the time. That there is real fatigue involved there. So building up that psychological safety and having the two-way feedback happening for somebody to be like, can you just give me until January? Like, let me get through the holidays. And then I'm all ears, but I'm kind of at capacity for your new idea, new solution, new thing in place. And if you can have that, then you can move so much faster for it. People will champion it when they're prepared to champion it and be honest when like, today's not the day, this week isn't the day, this quarter, whatever it may be, I'm at capacity, I need some breathing room.
Yeah, and this is fascinating. I have two questions on this. One is is there any specific questions that you're asking on the interview to figure out whether the person is really comfortable with change? And two, are there specific guardrails that you're putting in the work so that people don't get overwhelmed with this particular change? So let's start first with the interviewing. How do you signal, I guess, to the interviewee, and how do you get that insight that they would be okay with this type of change pacing?
Anyone that's ever interviewed with me and then ultimately get hired and you have those conversations after the fact, they will say like, Melissa, I've never been to an interview where somebody spent the time trying to talk me out of it. But so that's very much my interview style of I will come in hot, like pros, cons, everybody has their list. So here's what's on the cons list. I'm just going to be real with you. This is what it is. And come in and say, like, this is what energizes me, making a change, making an impact, coming into work on Monday morning at 8 a.m. And by Monday morning at 9 a.m., my plan for the week has kind of just gone out the door. And you can see people just visibly like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. And can kind of see right through it. They're just immediate physical reactions to like, that's not it. And then just any level of basic questions around like, tell me about the biggest change you went through on your team in the last year. Tell me about a time at work where you had a change. And people tend to reveal themselves pretty quickly. And it's quick to see like which side of camp they're on. We went through this and it was a train wreck because there wasn't enough thought put behind it, or we went too fast in implementing the change. I'm sure all those things are true, but then I can promise you, you're going to say all those same things about what we got going on here. And so just being like super transparent about those things. There's plenty of people that of stuff that I love about my job that's on the pros list is at the top of somebody else's cons list, and vice versa. Things that would drive me crazy and are on top of my cons list are on the pros list for somebody else. So just being really kind of clear of what the overall culture is here in regards to innovation and change, and just picking up on body cues.
Yeah. And it really depends on the personality of the person as well. And, you know, what type of culture they really excel in, because if they are not the person that excels in that type of culture, you don't really want them in the company, because the company is, they're not going to be happy. You're not going to be happy. It's just not a good fit. And why waste yours and theirs time?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite sayings, because I think business is just relationships at the end of the day, and talking about it, is you can have two fantastic people in a failed marriage. It does, like, it is not always somebody's a monster and someone else gave it their all. Like, you can have two wonderful people and like the relationship just doesn't work. And that's very much, I find the same thing in the workplace. I've had direct reports come and go before and go and be insanely successful and happy somewhere else, and they were miserable here. And that's okay. Like, that's completely okay, because it's a, employment is a two-way street, and I fully support that as a leader of, I want you excited coming to work every day. I want you loving what you're doing. I want it to be a good culture fit for you as well. And so being very clear of like, here's my baggage. Let me wheel my luggage into the interview of this is what it's like to work for me, to work here. And it's not for everybody. And that doesn't mean anything, but especially when people are gainfully employed, convincing anyone to leave their place of employment to come work here and then have them find out, it usually reveals itself quickly, right? 3-4 weeks in, like, whoa, I don't think this is going to be the place for me. Like, just say all that stuff up front.
Yeah, that's good. So the other question that I had was, in terms of guardrails when you're making changes, how do you make sure that, is there some type of tracker that you're doing, or anything that it's sort of more official than just, I guess, keeping it in your head, how many changes you're implementing within a year? Are you putting the guardrails in of saying, we're not going to implement more than 3 changes, 4 changes, whatever that might be? How do you keep that on a, you know, digestible level?
Yes. We follow in BOS, EOS is the more traditional term out there. We follow a system there. So we have our annual goals and then broken down into quarterly rocks for everyone to carry their part in that. And so we are, while being flexible and adaptable and everything else, of being clear that this is business changes, life changes, but this is what we set out to do. And if you put too many things in place that then distract from being able to accomplish those things, it's not going to work, right? Like, you're not going to get to where you're going. It's so easy to get sidetracked on this journey, and then look up and be like, oh my gosh, we were supposed to be going west and suddenly we took enough left turns and we're headed east. So being really keeping those annual goals, the quarterly rocks, top of mind and speaking to them consistently is the probably, I'm not going to say it's informal, because I mean, that's a relatively, if anybody's ever followed an EOS structure, it's a very formal structure. But keeping that kind of at our center, and that I think provides its own guardrails to things far outside of change as well. But like, we got a pace car and make sure that we're getting where we're going.
Yep. And for a listener, just to clarify, EOS stands for Entrepreneurial Operating System. It is essentially a system that smaller to mid-sized businesses can plug into to get better systems, operations, people, and data. So it's a whole system that I think it was Gino Wickman that did it. Yes. You know, I work myself with smaller businesses as well. So a lot of them are swearing by the EOS and it really transformed their business in a very short amount of time. Go in a little bit of a different direction because your role as a CFO has expanded beyond just traditional finance. Now you have responsibilities in ops and HR, also sales recently. So when you put these different hats on, the ops role, the sales role, the HR role, how is that different from your finance hat?
Finance at the end of the day is the sum of operations. So I've always thought like operations and finance are one of the same. I think you're seeing a lot of that evolution in business, certainly in smaller businesses, but even into the mid-size and larger businesses of this like COO and CFO role starting to cross over, if not merge. I have several people in my network that officially carry the CFOO title of Chief Financial and Operations Officer. So from day one, I came in with a job title of CFO and VP of Operations because I just think they're one of the same. And I think no one is better to view and analyze operations than a finance brain. Business is numbers at the end of the day. It's dollars and it's cents and it's margins and percentages and everything else. And there's no one better to analyze those trends, good, bad, or indifferent, than somebody that has a finance background. So I really think like that overlap has always been there. I think it's really powerful and it brings a unique perspective. I think it also respects the changing role of the office of the CFO. Instead of, I wasn't in the role, but from my understanding, you know, 20 years ago, it was very still past focus, closing the books, compliance, putting together the budget and a couple of future focused things, but very like reporting, compliance, wrapping things up. And now it's playing this real strategic role. And I think that's the implementation of operations. As far as like the biggest difference, I think, between the two, or how do you switch between the hats? I think it's all one of the same, but just viewing it through a bit of a different lens. I will say taking on the sales team this year was not in my bingo card, and has pushed me far outside of my comfort zone. But that's one specifically that I have to really be clear in a meeting, in a conversation, like, am I acting as the CFO right now, or am I acting as the head of sales? And being clear on which role I'm stepping into in the moment, because, you know, sales naturally would like to spend a lot of money. that they're, you know, between sales and marketing, they want to be your high spenders. And so am I, like, which role am I in? But I think there's so much efficiencies to be found by combining these roles and really understanding the ins and outs. Business as a whole, I believe we've torn down a lot of silos and old school traditional thinking in that way. So this overseeing what feels some days like all of them, it's been super efficient. We can go just kind of direct to the decision maker and understand kind of the pieces of everybody else that it affects as well.
And that's, you know, everything that you do in the business is eventually going to end up in finances. So
it is. Yeah.
You're actually seeing that before it becomes a P&L or a balance sheet item. And you can, you know, you are there and leading that conversation versus trying to report back on it.
Absolutely. And then there's a difference of, And most CFOs in my network are brilliant in this area. So it's not a dig on the role in any capacity, but it's so different when you've been out on the floor and you're immersed in the operations than when you see it in black and white, when you're closing the books or putting together the projections or anything else. Like, you understand intimately the ins and outs of it, the work, the heart that goes into something, how, you know, if you somehow are dealing with the customer complaint at times that then ultimately resulted in that revenue line item, because it was resolved positively, that like being in those operations, it brings clarity to the CFO role as well. And it's my motto as a CFO is people over profit, because your people ultimately are responsible for your profit. And being in it, being in the operations, being in charge of the people, it really brings so much clarity to that CFO role.
Yeah. And I also like to think about it too, in terms of, you know, when you're just looking at the spreadsheets and the numbers and you have conversations about that, it seems very black and white. But once you step outside of that world and you actually try to be and be in the shoes of someone who's in sales or marketing and operations, it takes that black and white world and just infuses it with all these colors. Yeah. And it makes such a big difference on someone being a finance leader.
Yes, I agree.
So what has been your one of the biggest challenges as you have been scaling the finance operations from, you know, when you first started to where it is now? I'm really curious, because you guys have just expanded in growth.
I'm going to speak to the business as a whole, not necessarily the finance department. We've stayed pretty lean and mean, but the business as a whole, we're in a really unique cash flow business. So we're public adjusters, super quick. We work property insurance claims. We advocate on behalf of the policyholder. So we go toe-to-toe, head-to-head up against your carrier to get them to pay your claim appropriately. In the simplest form, we get your insurance company to write checks. And then our revenue stream is straight contingency. We take a percentage of that check. That process, how long it takes, boy, it can be a journey. If everything goes great, 4 months, I have claims I have settled 5 years later in litigation. So we've scaled rapidly and exponentially at very, very high pace. Our lowest year has been around 78% growth in the 7 years that I have been here. So significant evolutions of a company, levels of change from startup to where we're at right now. And the biggest challenge has been cash flow challenges, because we're in this unique position that when you grow, we're service-based, but when you grow, if even consider volume at a 78% pace or 100% pace, I have to today service claims at a high level at 100% growth that I'm going to get paid on 6 months from now. And then by the time you get to that 6 month point, we've scaled another 50% or whatever it may be again and again and again. So the biggest challenge for us has been, and it's been the most fun part of my role over the last 7 years. It makes me gray a little bit, but I've loved it. With this extreme delay in our actual cash flow collections, how do we continue to scale at this level of pace for money that we may or may not see? I mean, because like I just said, it could be 4 months or it could be 5 years. And depending on the size of claim, like, that's a little bit of a cash flow projection nightmare. But it's made it super interesting and unique and something like I've never experienced. So that has, without a doubt, been the number one challenge.
And when you're talking about this exponential growth, is that growth in the number of volume of claims or in the number of size of the claims, or basically both as well?
Yeah, it's been both volume in claims and then higher dollar claims. The bigger you build your company, the more brand awareness you build, the more positive history you have there. Like, nobody's turning over. We work a lot of university campuses at this point. And so you could be talking like a $10 to $25 million claim. No one's turning that over to a public adjuster in its first year of business, yeah. Right? That there needs to be like a history, a proven history there that you can handle something of that size. So we have scaled both in dollar value of claim and then overall quantity that we are working year over year. So it's been a combination of both. It's been an intentional growth on both parts without getting like too into the nitty gritty details of claims, because I'm sure it's boring to a lot of people.
That's me. I could actually talk about this for hours if you wanted to.
But. Yeah, but it, for the most part, costs the same amount of money, time, energy, resources to work a $50,000 claim that it does to work a $50 million claim. And we take a straight percentage of the check. So any finance brain out there can do just some, you know, quick mental math and see what the profit margins are going to be on one or the other. But at the same time, it's a heck of a lot easier to get an insurance carrier to write a $50,000 check than it is to pick up the phone and ask for $5, $10, $15, $50 million as well. So it's been like a balancing act of the bigger claims take longer. So you're delaying your cash flow further, but you still need the resources here to work through it. So the quicker, smaller claims will keep the lights on, be more consistent, quick turnover of revenue. Yeah, I could nerd out on it all day, every day, but it's been so much fun, but such a challenge.
I don't know how in particular you can go into this, but this obviously poses a cash flow problem. What if you have implemented that gets your cash faster in a way? So you have said smaller claims. That is there anything else that you're using as a terms of strategy that you can get that cash a little bit faster versus waiting years and years down the line?
Oh gosh. There's so many interesting facets to that question, but there's like twofold. A, I have to get the carrier to agree to write an estimate and ultimately release a check. And then it is an unnecessarily complicated journey between that agreement and actually receiving the money. So there's literally two folds of answering that of like, how can we get it bought? We call it bought, get our estimate bought faster. And then once the estimate is bought, how can I collect it faster? To not go on and on and on here, I will say the biggest learning lesson of something that we've implemented, because typically when you come to insurance claims, there's usually a bank involved, somebody else that's also owed the money here, is the more proactive communication you can have. So when we start talking about seven-figure checks, typically I am reaching out to the loan holder, to the mortgage banker, and having a conversation before the money arrives. One of my favorite sayings in this role is like, the person who holds the check holds the power. Mm-hmm. And once money gets involved, it gets messy and there's feelings. And most of the time it's the largest check that somebody's physically held, because the insurance industry is still like literal physical checks. Most businesses, I feel like I've moved on from it and know there's a physical check coming in the mail every time, is that proactive communication. So before the money's here, before people are emotional about it, like, here's where we're at in the process. I think a settlement is coming. I think an estimate is coming. Your name's going to be listed on it. My name's going to be listed on it. Here's the process I would like this to follow. But at the end of the day, like, we all got to agree here of how this money is going to flow so that the insured can get their property restored to its full value, so that we can be paid the fee that's due, so that you as a lien holder on the property can feel comfortable with where the money's moving and make sure that your collateral is restored to its full value as well, and getting out ahead of it. Assumptions make asses, right?
Yep.
So not assuming that everyone's going to be cool with the process. We work thousands of claims a year, okay? So you get, it's just another claim sometimes to us. Like, you get so used to it. If you've ever done something repeatedly, whatever it may be. Like, you get so used to it. So I used to work at Levy Restaurants. They run the food and beverage and hospitality at like arenas and ballparks and convention centers. And I ran an arena, ballpark, and convention center in downtown Omaha. And you literally work in the vault. Back in the day, I sound ancient, when people used cash, right? But at the end of an event, you're counting all the cash that came in from the concessions from that championship volleyball game or March Madness or whatever it may be. And it can be millions of dollars. And there's enough time that you handle tired, wanting to go home on a Saturday night, millions of dollars of cash, that it just becomes another Saturday.
It's business as usual. Yep.
Yeah. Like the first time, I remember just being so stressed, overwhelmed. Right. And so that can happen anywhere and it can sneak in. So we work thousands of claims. And so it would be really easy for us. Like, it's just another 7-figure check that's getting released. And you just kind of get going with the flow and going with the motions of assuming that this one's going to go just like the last one. And you have to pause and take a step back and say, on a personal level, have I ever physically been mailed $1.5 million check, a $5 million check? No, I haven't ever had that experience outside of in a business world. And so then, like, this is the largest check most people have ever physically touched, physically handled. A lot of times it's the biggest loss they've experienced in their life, whether it's their personal home or their business or their warehouse, and operations are at a complete standstill. They're waiting for this. Like, this is the claim of their life. And so again, just like taking that second to pause, perspective is powerful. This is the biggest thing they have going on. A lot of times banks, this may be the largest insurance claim that they've personally dealt with. And so taking that time to reach out before the money's involved and have that conversation has moved money so much faster for everyone involved. Certainly for us, and that's a pro for us as a business, but it's gotten the money moving so much faster than when somebody gets it. Like, hey, wait a minute, what are we supposed to be doing here? This suddenly feels weird. I don't like the way this is going down. I don't trust this to be in the mail, whatever that may be. So just getting kind of like on that same page before it's here has been the biggest thing. Communication solves so much, doesn't it?
Yeah, surprisingly, right? Mm-hmm. So Melissa, this has been an absolute pleasure of a conversation. I've learned so much about insurance also. But my last question for you is, and we've talked about this, I want to end with this topic, is what is your top piece of advice for fellow CFOs and CEOs on how they can balance their rising SaaS and cloud costs and keep the business moving forward?
Be clear of what problems you are trying to solve, and then be flexible about the solution, but do not be flexible about finding a solution and being flexible of applying it to a problem. Like, this is what we're going to tackle this quarter, this year, whatever it may be. It's all going to solve a problem, but that solution is going to come with a hefty price tag on it. So making sure that you're not just getting swept away by the latest and greatest, and stay focused on that priority list and taking that seriously.
Great advice. Thank you so much for being on the show, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.